Hi, you're listening to The Table Podcast from April 16th, 2017. Today's podcast is titled, The Unexpected Path.
I'm tired of disintegrated spirituality. I'm tired of ways of looking at the world that feel like they have as their end game the eradication of mystery, the defining of the divine, that seem to be more about using understanding as a weapon than as a welcome mat for what we don't know. And I'm tired of Easter, in particular what is often categorically understood to be the Christian version of Easter, behaving like that. So here in this gathering, where we cherish and celebrate and also try to foster the freedom to explore what we believe, I want to approach our marking of Easter a bit differently. I would like us to consider being open to wonder, which I think it's fair to say might often be a feature of Christian Easter celebrations, in fact, most often. And I would like us to be open to that, but not open to wonder as an anomaly. Do we all know that word, anomaly? We use it. I think it's fairly common, but I thought I'd look it up just in case I was misusing it. Here's the dictionary definition. An anomaly is something different, abnormal, peculiar, or not easily classified. So you can see how I would imagine that in gatherings everywhere this morning, Easter morning, there's conversation about an anomaly. See, I think that this is one of the places where our search for God, our exploration of belief, can easily get derailed into what's often a pretty fruitless debate about the nature of miracles. Easter Sunday, of course, is the day when Christendom remarks resurrection. In many instances, an entire argument for the meritorious existence of the Christian religion gets pinned to what is treated as an anomaly, an abnormality, or a peculiarity for which we use a word like miracle. It's essentially a way of thinking that says, because we have this story in which an event happens that we can't explain, what we believe is true. And that's a very fragile position, as perhaps we can appreciate, and it's one that's frequently critiqued. And I'm going to suggest that some of that critique has merit, because the idea, as I've framed it at least, is too small. It makes something about which we can't be certain become the determining factor for what many would say we have to be certain about. It takes the power out of doubt. And in the end, it doesn't foster faith in God as easily as it fosters faith in a system of belief. And so this morning, Easter morning, having broken our fast together with the collective generosity from this community, I want to invite us to explore what we believe about what constitutes a miracle. And I would like us to begin by letting go of what we think we know, or at least choosing to be open to the possibility that there is more to be discovered. I believe that when we pray, we're participating in the ongoing creative work of God and making the world a better place. Prayer is mysterious, for sure. That's one of the reasons we struggle with it. But for all that, it seems like a good place to begin. So I want to invite you to do this together. You don't have to, of course, but if you wish to, I want you to know of the warmth of the invitation to do it. So what I want to invite you to do is, I'll lead us in a prayer in just a moment, but I want you to begin listening to that prayer and praying it with me by closing your hands into fists and putting them palm down. You can put them on your thighs or on the table in front of you, wherever you wish, but closed hand, palm down. And over the course of the prayer, move from there to hands turned so your palms are up and your hands are open. So from clenched fist, palm down, to open hand, palm up over the course of the prayer. We'll have a little bit of silence after we pray, after the spoken words of the prayer, and then we'll sing together. We'll learn a song together that I think also opens onto the idea that there's more to wonder than just an anomaly. So let's pray together. Gentle me, Holy One, into an unclenched moment, a deep breath, a letting go of heavy expectancies, of shriveling anxieties, of dead certainties, that softened by the silence, surrounded by the light, and open to the mystery, I may be found by wholeness, upheld by the unfathomable, entranced by the simple, and filled with the joy that is you. May it be so. Let's sing together. The internet has given us the gift of almost effortless dissemination of misattributed quotes. And of course, it's also given us the dubious gift of trying to give whatever point we're making more weight by using a quote from a famous person to back us up. This seems to be especially helpful in the comments section. And so this happened to me a few weeks ago. I heard someone online attribute the following quote to Albert Einstein. This is the quote: "There are only two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing is a miracle. The other is as though everything is." Now, you know how fond I am of binary thinking, of taking complex things and turning them into either-or dichotomies. Well, this quote does that with the idea of miracles, and it also does it with the possible ways we might live our lives, all or nothing. Either it's all a miracle or none of it is. We either live one way or the other. Binary thinking, courtesy of a genius who taught us that time isn't necessarily linear. I think we should be suspicious of the attribution. But the quote caught my attention for a few reasons. Having been so critical of its binary shape, I have to honestly say that the first reason it caught my attention is because I liked it. I still like it. What I like about it is the possibility it stirs in me. The possibility that the idea that miracles equals anomalies is not a great way to think or to live. I like the thought that the world in which I live is infused with the miraculous. And I like the picture that I get in my imagination of that crazy white afro-haired guy sitting at his desk contemplating the nature of things like energy and time, and then having a sort of aha moment, this epiphany in which he blurts out, "It's all a miracle, or I'm not Albert Einstein." Yeah. Well, as it turns out, it would be overdoing it to confidently attribute the quote to Einstein. It could have been written by a greeting card guru in some cubicle, for all we can say with certainty. But I haven't been able to shake the idea that living as though I'm surrounded by the miraculous beats thinking of miracles as anomalies, hands down. Haven't been able to shake that one. Let's sing together.
So what is a miracle anyway? Here's another definition for you. By definition, a miracle is an extraordinary event manifesting divine intervention in human affairs. So that's Merriam-Webster at work right there. To put it another way, we have historically thought of miracles as times when God, or what we might call divine agency, fiddles with nature, or in philosophical terms, fiddles with natural law. And we're not going to take the time this morning to really dig into the ideas behind natural law. It's a biggie. But for our purposes, let's say it's the idea that both in nature and in human behavior, there is a universal, unchanging law given by the divine that holds for all that is. And that law can be uniquely known by humanity through reason, which is also given to us by the divine. And if you like that definition and you want to properly attribute it, Augustine and Aquinas basically gave us that one. So that's credit where it's due. Now, building on Augustine and Aquinas comes Thomas Hobbes, whom some of you probably bumped into somewhere in an intro class, a survey class of some nature or other. He affirmed the idea of natural law, but he added this idea to it. There is a natural law, says Hobbes. It's universal. It applies to all it is. And it may change over time. I like it. That's a rather important tweak to the idea of natural law. I think we could all agree. Even if we accept the idea that there's a natural law that doesn't change, all we have to do is move our perspective forward or backward in time a little to see that our understanding of those laws can change a lot. Enough, in fact, to seriously challenge the idea that there can be any constant understanding of ideas like natural or miracle or even divine agency. Let me give you some idea what I'm talking about. Here's a pretty everyday example. In our house, we've slowly been swapping out our incandescent light bulbs for LED light bulbs. As late as the 1850s, the way that an LED works would have been clearly, and by the definitions we've just been working with, understood by a physicist to be a miracle. Defied all the known laws of nature. An LED light bulb. See what I'm saying? On a slightly more esoteric note, nuclear decay would have been regarded as a miracle. And now school kids talk about half-life of nuclear waste. These things would have been understood to be miracles not because they were entirely unfamiliar necessarily, but because the way they worked clearly violated scientific and natural laws as they were then understood. And nowadays, it's not like it ended in the 1850s. Nowadays, things like dark matter violate our current scientific and natural laws, but we don't tend to call them miracles. Why is that? Well, arguably, it's because the scientists made the observations first, not the church fathers. It's also because of the divine agency part of that definition. If we can observe something, this is our culture's perspective, if we can observe something by scientific means, then no matter how exotic or mysterious it may be, we don't regard its existence as an anomaly requiring divine agency. I'm going to just go through that sentence one more time because I couldn't even read it clearly. Never mind, have everyone kind of go, oh yeah. So, reasons why we don't call things like dark matter miracles in our culture was what I was trying to illuminate here just a little bit. Observe by science. All right? The divine agency part of the definition, if we can observe something by scientific means, then it doesn't matter how exotic or mysterious it is, we don't regard its existence as an anomaly that requires divine agency, if we can observe it by scientific means. That's the way our culture's thinking about these ideas operates. All right? What's divine agency anyway? By the way, we're still talking about Easter here. Because a lot of folks are holding the whole plot of the story together by an anomaly called the resurrection. So stay with me. We're going to get back to that in due course. In the meantime, I think it's worth being aware that as recently as the time of Galileo, anything above the clouds, that's pretty low today, anything above the clouds or more than a couple hundred feet below the earth was known to be outside of nature. In other words, it was the realm of the divine. And it wasn't very long ago, historically, that humans believed that we could literally reach heaven if we just had a tall enough ladder. Actually. Maybe when we think about things like that, it would be fair to say that a more honest definition of divine agency is anything we don't ultimately understand or anything we don't understand fully. So guess where this takes us? If what is ultimately behind, what ultimately causes everything, remains elusive to us, and it does, no matter how deeply we delve into nature, then the quote that we started with, either it's all a miracle or none of it's a miracle, no matter who said it, has merit. Because everything in the universe flows from ultimate causality. Either everything is mere nature, or it's all gloriously miraculous. And we can make an argument for both, and they both work. But frankly, there's only one of them that I find inspiring. Think about it this way. If we regard the world as just molecular machinery, in quotes, and the way that we perceive things, including the divine, as nothing but chemistry in the brain, and as recently as about 2-3 months ago, might have been 6 months ago, but in the last few months, we've been able to recreate in the lab what happens in our brain in worship. So we can now take somebody into the lab and have them have a worship experience. It's the same brain stuff. Fascinating, right? All to say, if the way we perceive and experience things, including God, is nothing but chemistry in the brain, we still have to account for the observable fact that when atoms self-assemble to make molecules, something more emerges. From the nothing but of atoms and hydrogen and oxygen emerges the something more of waterfalls, oceans, rainbows. When atoms self-assembled into the first cells, from just chemistry emerged the something more of sexuality, communication, ecology, culture, art, love. And if the idea that nothing but bright light can evolve into the person sitting next to you in a mere 14 billion years is a miracle, I don't think it matters how thoroughly we describe the process. If that can happen, that's a miracle. Right? So from where I sit, it looks like we're surrounded by the miraculous. Now, if you really wanted to take the time to make all of this come home, I think there's some ways to do it. They do take a little bit of commitment. And they might be hard to do, at least the first one or two that I'm going to suggest might be uniquely hard to do today because they involve finding a patch of dry ground. But if you have a moment or several, and you really want to kind of engage with this, probably the simplest way to do it is find a dry patch of earth where you can lie down and put your face close to the grass and then be still. And if you really have the time, stay still long enough to see the dead stem uncurl and see the brown turn to green and see this thing that a month ago was utterly, solidly dead come to life. We were driving into the city the other day, and Taya was in the back seat, and the boulevards are starting to turn green. And I hear Taya back there, and she's going, "Go, go, go!" Like, she's cheering for the grass, right? That's awesome. Yeah, like that. Or if that's not approachable, you could try lying on your back. Might have to get outside the city for this one. Try lying on your back somewhere where you can see the stars. And then try to explain the ultimate causality of the night sky to a 4-year-old. And if you really want to wrestle with it, try to explain it to the 4-year-old we talked about last week, whose father committed suicide. Right? Try that. Or really, attend to almost anything that moves you, that really moves you, but especially the things that take you by surprise. Especially the things where you feel something welling up inside of you and go, "This doesn't equal that." Especially those. And then ask yourself, how is this possible? How is this possible? See, now we're in the terrain that resurrection points to. Because what resurrection points to is the possibility that when we encounter wonder, beauty, hope, love, goodness, truth in this world, what we're encountering is not an anomaly. It's what is embedded in, it's what animates everything around us. It's what's moving all of life forward. It is the common occupied by the divine, something we already sang about together. Somehow the common becomes the divine. Resurrection says that just when we thought the story was over and darkness had the last word, something more appeared. From the commonness of death, new life emerges. From the despair of Friday, the mysterious and confounding hope of Sunday springs over and over and over again. How is this possible? Unless a seed goes into the ground and dies, Jesus says, new life doesn't happen. When temples that took 40-some years to build get torn down, they get rebuilt in 3 days. It's all rather strange. How is this possible? The path to restoration, this story tells us, the path to renewal isn't an anomaly. It's unexpected because it passes through darkness. But it's not an anomaly. It's as common as the world around us. Our job is to learn to see it. What I want to do, Kim's going to play a little U-bass solo for us here while I get sorted, because in the midst of all the lovely things that we were setting up and getting going here this morning, I did something that I frequently do when I have this kind of a feature to what a talky bit. I need a resource that I left in my bag. What I want to do is leave us with a poem. And one of the reasons I want to do that is because it's a fabulous poem, but also because it's the poets who tend to use the sort of language that make room for the common to be the divine. Other ways of exploring that are less artful tend to fence in ideas too soon. So this is from, a favorite poet and an acquaintance, someone that I appreciate, Malcolm Guite. I've shared some of his other work with you before. This is from a collection of his work called The Singing Bowl, which as it goes is a series of poems that he wrote sort of as he was having life experiences. So it's a little bit of a biographical collection in some ways, and they have titles that are specific to place. And this one is called Out in the Elements, Grantchester. And it's important to know about Malcolm also, not only does he look, as I've said here before, like the love child of a hobbit and an Ewok, but it is true, isn't it, Sarah? I know. If you've ever seen a picture of him, you'll affirm this description, I believe. And also, he's a pipe smoker, a committed pipe smoker, and it's an important feature of the poem. One of the important images here is about that. And so, there you go. This to me, this poem pulls together the ideas that we've been poking at a little bit this morning. I crunch the gravel on my raveled walks and clamber with my boots in the wet clay, for I myself am clay that breathes and talks, articulated earth. I move and pray, alive at once to walk and be the way. The root beneath, the branch above the tree, these hedges bright with blossom, white with May, everything concentrates, awaits in me the coming of the one who sets creation free. The earth opens now to sudden drumming rains, the raised and falling waters of the sea, whose tidal pull and play is in my veins, spilling and spreading, filling, flowing free, whose ebb and flow is still at work in me. And in the booming pulse of play and work, when heartbeats pushed in waves of empathy till the waters broke and bore me from the dark and found this foundered shore and took me from the ark. As rain recedes, I pause to fill my pipe and kindle fire that flickers into light and lights the leaf all curled and cured and ripe within a burr-starred bowl. How fierce and bright it glows against the cold, and I delight in the taste and fragrance, watching wisps of gray and graceful smoke in their brief flight. As the sun breaks from the clouds and lights my way, I feel the fire that makes the light, that makes the day. Now air is all astir in breaks and blasts. The last gray rags of cloud are blown aside. The hedgerows hush and rustle in the gusts as clean winds whistle round me. Far and wide, bent grasses and frail flowers lean aside. I breathe the world in with this brimming breeze that tugs at me and eddies at my side, quickens and flickers through the tangled trees and breathes me back to life and brings me to my knees. Akin to every creature, I will learn from each and all the meaning of my birth. I love the dust to which I will return, the subtle substance of my mother earth, from water born by fire fathered forth, an index and epitome of nature. I sum and summon all the world is worth, and breathing now his elemental air, I find the one within, without, and everywhere. I find the one within, without, and everywhere. All right. We have all the littles back. We're going to sing together. And while we sing, we're going to share the symbolic feast that, as Atticus is showing us the way. Atticus went first, but if I could get an adult to take that bowl and pass it to the rest of us, enjoy the feast, buddy. We're going to share communion while we sing together, all right? Perfect.
We hope you've enjoyed today's teaching. Find more podcasts and information about our community at thetablewinnipeg.com.